Welcome to the Deep Learning Podcast powered by DESI AI. I'm your host, Harpreet Sahota. In this podcast, we talk about all things deep learning, from computer vision to generative AI. Join me as I sit down with some of the brightest minds in research, application, and industry to learn about the stories, challenges, and innovations that are shaping the future of artificial intelligence. What sets this podcast apart is that our interviews are community-driven. They're often Ask Me Anything sessions that give you, the listener, a unique opportunity to shape the conversation. If you want to be part of a vibrant community and have a say in future discussions, join the Deep Learning Daily community by heading over to deeplearningdaily.community. This will bring you right into our Discord server, where you can stay updated on all our events and take part in conversations, hacky hours, and just general fun in the Discord community. Whether you're a seasoned expert or just curious about the field, there's always something new to discover on the show. Before we dive into the episode, a special thanks to our sponsor, DESI AI. DESI is the organization behind models such as DESI LM, DESI Coder, DESI Diffusion, YOLO NAS, and YOLO NAS Pose. Let's introduce our guest and jump right into the program. What's up, everybody? Welcome. Welcome to today's Ask Me Anything session. Welcome to the Deep Learning Daily Community Ask Me Anything series. Our guest today is a self-taught computer scientist and machine learning engineer with a ton of experience using AI to build smarter software systems. Over the past 7 years, her focus has been building production-grade AI systems in the industry, solving real-world engineering challenges for businesses at all stages and in all industries, ranging from e-commerce and insurance to media and entertainment. She has literally played a hand in all parts from the ML lifecycle, from product development to developing data labeling pipelines to ML model deployment for applications. More recently, though, in the quest to replicate human intelligence, she's been exploring and making contributions to three different research areas: AutoML, emotion recognition, and multi-agent systems. And if all that wasn't impressive enough already, she's currently authoring a book for O'Reilly Publications, tentatively titled LLM Ops, Managing Large Language Models in Production. And she's authoring a course about deploying ML models to production that will teach data scientists the fundamentals of machine learning software systems and how to deploy machine learning models to production. Please help me in welcoming our guest today, Abby Arian. Abby, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be on the show today. Appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This is the first time we're having like a formal conversation. I feel weird because you're my favorite.
Yes. Yes. I'm the stern-faced podcast interviewer now. No, of course not. Abby is a good friend of mine, and it's an absolute pleasure to have Abby here on the podcast. Super smart, super just intelligent, and all-around awesome person. So happy that you're here, Abby. So the first question that people are interested in are the key challenges when refining MLOps practices to incorporate LLMs. So let me phrase this as a question then. So what are the key challenges faced when refining MLOps practices to incorporate large language models, especially with regards to computational resources?
I think the big problem with large language models is it depends. So I'll put it this way, which is there, as of now, there are definitely three kinds of distributions that have occurred in the industry. The first is basically the companies that are building the foundation models, the very specific AI doing one labs, OpenAI, all of those. Their problems are uniquely different. I don't think they're limited by compute because I've been reading some work where alerts, the way they've been evaluating the models, the way they've been training the models isn't really the most efficient, which is basically there's data implication and various things, which is there's some improvement that can happen on top of the data that they're already collecting, because with any kind of machine learning model, the accuracy is really just as good as your data itself. So I would probably not say that they're using high quality data. I would more likely say they're using tons of data because they honestly have access to it. There's not a lot of work that is going into like refining the data. It happens over a period of time, but the focus is more like exponential results. The second are the kind of companies that have realized, okay, fine, despite the fact that there are APIs available for accessing these models, it's not ideal. And it will become very expensive very quickly to be able to use any of these API-based models, proprietary models, we can call them. So the big questions for them when it comes to computational resources is how to be efficient, because while they do have the money to be able to train the models, they do not have unlimited access to data itself. So for them, and I mean, when it comes to computational resources, again, the multitude at which the difference happens. So for example, Replit falls into one of those categories. A company that is training their own models isn't really using OpenAI models necessarily, is looking into a lot of open source models as well. But still, again, they would not be able to match like the OpenAI level of compute. So for them, it becomes very important to look at, you know, the basic data processing. And, you know, if just doing more work on that part, which is how do we work around the challenges that come with this? So the first challenge would be, let's say, data leak. That is the biggest challenge, which is most of the large language models, if you're looking at them, the way that they learn things, they memorize a lot of stuff. And that is one of the reasons that we have leaks happening, because again, now, obviously, there are ways to deal with that. So with the companies like those, they are implementing strategies. So for example, when it comes to pre-processing stage, they are looking at strategies like data sanitization. I know that they've been implementing their deduplication, which happens to be one of the two core strategies, but sanitization also happens to be one of the other ones. In training itself, I've seen a lot of companies, and you know, regularization was something that we were already doing before. I've seen some people already using some level of knowledge distillation, which was more commonly used in the IoT sector because they were compressing models to be able to run them on smaller devices. Now we're almost at the same point where we are sort of matching up that scale already, which is our models are too big for the devices that we are trying to run our models on. So while previously it was like, hey, we have deep learning models and then we are trying to run them on Arduino Raspberry Pi. Now it's basically, we have billions of parameters and we're trying to run them on computers. And obviously now it has gone distilled down to basically running it on Raspberry Pi and all of that stuff. And the final thing where I think I've seen more work is in post-processing. There are people who are implementing strategies like convergence masking and filtering. This is the kind of work that I've not been seeing happening. Like maybe it happens at Microsoft, but I've not seen extensive work or extensive research published, at least by OpenAI, where they're investing that much effort into doing this thing very specifically. And then there are third kind of companies that are using the APIs right now. They're not really building their own models because they're limited in terms of training itself, which is they don't have the compute available to, you know, train the models. And obviously, they may not have access to the data. So that becomes all the new companies that are coming into this space. So for them, they are looking at different things, which is, you know, the strategies that they're using is more like query caching, let's say, or can we cache the results that are happening over and over again? Can we concatenate the results so that basically if two queries are being if two inferences are being queried over and over again, can we somehow through similarity search come up with something which is an approximate answer for that? So those are the three key differences when it comes to like how different companies are dealing with compute in the data collection, the labeling process itself. Obviously, it's across the board, which is it's not very specific to, you know, just the collection, the labeling process. It comes to, you know, these are the strategies you're using very much in fine-tuning as well, too.
We'll get back to the show after a quick word from our sponsors, Desi AI. I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Inferi. Inferi is Desi's inference SDK that's tailored specifically to accelerate generative AI models in production. It incorporates features such as selective quantization, hybrid compilation, pipeline orchestration, optimized CUDA kernels, continuous batching, and optimized beam search. Inferi offers a plug-and-play solution to boost the efficiency for Desi models and the broader generative AI landscape. Experience the difference it makes by heading over to desi.ai for a live demo with our latest large language models and diffusion models. Let's get back to the show. So like there's, you know, models that come out, open source models, you know, 180 billion parameter Falcon or 6 billion parameter Desi LM model. For these models that are coming out that are like open source, whose responsibility does it fall onto to like kind of make those models more efficient? Is it like the in-house team that is going to be using those language models to kind of find ways to make those models more efficient? Or, you know, are companies tending to rely on maybe vendors that specialize in doing something like this? Curious to get your thoughts on that.
So I think it will eventually come down to companies because there are two reasons for this. The way, if you're looking at the labeling companies that are out there, so companies like Snorkel and stuff that are working in this very, on this very specific problem itself, some of the key approaches that they're using to be able to get almost like approximate heuristics on the labels or approximate labels is basically active learning or self-supervised learning or weak supervised learning, where you're learning the weak connections between the data itself. But before we even get to that point, you have to have some data that is labeled in-house. Most of these companies, again, I am not entirely sure on what their budget is, but I'm not assuming it's super cheap. But even for them to be able to automate the entire process, you will need to have two extensive amount of work in-house, where you have at least thousands of data constantly coming in. And it becomes a little bit problematic as well, because now the model is constantly interacting with the real world, where you have more data coming in. Whereas in the previous process where we were mostly working with just native models, again, I think there were very few people who were working with generative models because of the limitation. So the main kinds of generative models were basically GANs that people were looking at, not necessarily in text itself. But on those ones, it was a little bit easier because, I mean, the way you're labeling image data is very different from the way you're labeling text data. It presents itself with new kinds of complexity. And one of the biggest things is you can't really tell if something has been labeled wrong just by looking at it. So it's extensive amount of work to be able to do fact checking and all of that stuff. So I don't believe that if you're working with vendors, they can fact check for every single industry.
Speaking of industries, so sourcing some questions from this awesome report that Abby had prepared on behalf of Laconia Capital. It's called Large Language Models Sector Deep Dive 2023. Definitely worth checking out. You can find it by going to Abby's website, which is just abbyarian.com, and you'll see it there. And I've prepared a bunch of questions on that. And one that is getting upvoted here is actually about the market landscape. What are the primary sectors or industries that are harnessing the capabilities of large language models in their operations?
I think the answer to that lies very much in the name itself, which is anywhere where we're looking at generation itself, whether that's generation of text, whether that's generation of audio, whether that's generation of caption for images, whether that's generation of video for images, those are the kind of industries where looking at the application itself. So it could be some of the common ones, I think, is very obvious to all of us, which is marketing or podcast summarization or, you know, any sort of summarization kind of thing. So for me, I think the answer is just very simple as that, which is anywhere where we were supposed to be generating. Now, one of the big changes that LLM have made is they've increased the efficiency of generation, which is the time it took to be able to build a model and then to be able to deploy that model. Now that has squeezed down. And so that's one of the reasons there's so much adoption right now, because there are so many applications of generating new scenarios, generating new kinds of text, generating copies of the text itself. And the way that large language models are learning is they learn via embeddings, right? Which is learning the inherent structure of the text itself that allows it to be able to adapt to new data, which was something that was incredibly hard before. So for example, one of the things that I was discussing, especially the books at Chiconia, was previously, if we were looking at, let's say, audio summarization or training a model that could recognize different languages or different kinds of audio, different dialects, we had to collect a data set for that particular language itself. And then to be able to train a model specifically for that language before we were able to generate predictions. Now that has shifted where we have now, if you're looking at some of the most common language models that have come out, they are models that do inherently have embeddings from different languages itself. And one of the more interesting things is they are able to adapt very well to new or unseen languages or unseen data sets as well. Would the accuracy be high? No, but would they be able to deal with outliers? Surely. Would they be able to generate near accurate prediction? It's unlikely, but would they be able to answer it and not just deliver gibberish or say, I cannot do anything? Well, most certainly. And depending on how those languages are similar, because languages do fall in that way, which is they're families of language that are structuring more similar to each other. So for them to be able to adapt to those languages becomes easy, even if you do not have a data set. So for example, there's a collection of languages that is called the romantic languages that are very similar inherently in structure, because all of them are derived from Latin itself. So for them to be able to, let's say we train a model on French and German and Spanish, I'm not really sure. I don't remember what the romantic languages are, but there's several languages. Let's say if we train a model on 5 of those 7 languages, it would be naturally be able to adapt or learn or to be able to answer things in the 6th or the 7th language itself, despite never having seen that language book in 50 years.
Thank you very much, Abby. People seem to be interested now in the blurring between ML ops and LLM ops. So I guess we should take the conversation there. Okay, so give us a quick rundown of how you define ML ops. And then from there, let's talk about how integrating large language models in LLM ops practices needs to be called LLM ops, right? Why isn't it the same thing?
Yeah, I think there's one big difference between both ML ops versus LLM ops. And that big difference is, what is the kind of model that we're looking at and how do we measure that model? So I think ML ops is really a term for as long as we are working with discriminative models, because the big focus is on accuracy of the model itself. We're able to define those categories very clearly, which is, this is accurate, this is not accurate, or prediction or whatever label that we are coming up with lies within the probability class that is already available to us. Whereas with generative, that becomes different. So it poses new problems or it poses new challenges where, since the goal of the two models becomes very different, so there are some parts that change as well. So one of the big parts that has changed is at least for the folks who came into MLOps and who came into ML quite a few years ago when we were just like 2016, 2017. So folks who've been there, a lot of time is really not spent on building the model, but on basically data collection, data labeling, data pre-processing took so much like entirety of effort. Most of the data scientists spent massive amount of time on that. I think that has decreased very much with LLMs. Now, where has that time gone? While they would still be focusing on, depending on the company, while there will be people still focusing on building the model, some people will be focusing on monitoring the model. But it has gone into that part where now, while things would have worked out very well previously without having a very strong monitoring team on hand, to now, that becomes very essential, which is when we're starting to think about having a reliability manager at hand. And it's not just, oh my God, we can have a reliability engineer. That has become one of the big, most important things. The second part is, how are we dealing with the constantly changing APIs, which is the work that a lot of ML engineers were doing before that has become one of the more important parts. The third most important part is basically everything on security and, how people are interacting with the model itself, which goes more towards, the new rule that is coming up, or a new rule that people are discussing, which is the AI engineer rule, which is basically the person who, once you've worked out the models, once you've created the service, then that person sort of ties together the model inside the application itself. So I feel like, there was this massive time in the entire ML life cycle that was spent on the earlier parts of the process. Now that has shifted from, we need to really focus on the layer part of the process where we're thinking about the user experience far more than is our data accurate or not, or how much data have we collected, how much data haven't we collected. While those things would still remain important for people who are still fine-tuning and, building up their own models, that shift has happened. The second thing is basically the way we are doing domain adaptation on the models, which is there are some people who are using RAGs, there are some people who are using vector databases, then there are some people who are using fine tuning. The challenges become very different. So for example, prompt engineering was not really a component that people were considering before the whole LLM thing. And now that has gotten added. Second thing is we spent a lot of time on feature stores. Now that is almost like, how much time are we really spending on storing the features? Like using applications like Feast, almost none. For me, at least, a lot of my time is really spent on packaging the models, testing the models in production, making sure that the alerts are working fine and everything. So that whole, now we have to create and package our model, it has decreased, which is maybe it has decreased because we have learned the technology, as in like there has been some maturity in the MLOps development. For quite a few years where it's not new anymore. There are quite sophisticated tools that you can use. The challenges are not really the same that there were in 2018 versus 2023. So while a lot of things, I think MLOps, the way it was built was really perfect in 2018, 2019, it's worked very well. There are a lot of tools that were built up till 2023. Now there are a lot of things that we can do just out of the box. The hint thing is most of the companies right now are not really, except healthcare. You could say except healthcare and finance, which are two very heavily compliant industries, would not have just one kind of model, which is they might have a generative model, but also a discriminative model. So, you can't, within the machine learning team, you can't really, one of the big problems that I faced was for the senior leadership to convince them to adopt a certain tool. It's not easy saying, let's go to Databricks now. Let's move to this new thing. Let's move to that new thing. So now it becomes very important to be able to have both the models, or at least the tools that we're using supporting both kinds of models for all the operations throughout the pipeline itself. Now, a lot of MLOps tools were not really built for that function, which is they cannot really support they're still building the functionality. They're figuring out how to be able to support the generative models, but they've not really built the tooling for generative models as such. So the infrastructure is missing for like a lot of MLOps tools. It will catch up in likely next 2-3 years or so, which is one of the reasons, if you've looked at the report inside chapter 4, we have specifically mentioned, which is inside the LLMOps tooling, there will be companies that have built tools in MLOps. They will still be building tools for LLMOps companies as well. But there will be some companies that will be primarily focusing on like generative LLMOps tooling. They won't be able to support discriminative models as such. So it comes down to, you know, what does our tech infrastructure look like? So that's the big difference, at least for me, which is for engineers, what tools are they using? How adaptable or how scalable these tools are when it comes to yesterday, when it comes to today? Do we really need to use 15 different ones, or do we use one single one that works across the organization and is reliable itself? Over the past, I would say, 8 to 9 months, there wasn't really a lot of focus on reliability as such, which is people were picking up everything that was coming up. You know, if something goes up viral on GitHub, people are like, let's start using it. But a lot of packages, a lot of tools have been built out by independent developers, which is basically data scientists, ML engineers have built a lot of stuff to be able to support their new demand in LLMOps industry. But would these tools be able to raise funding? Would these tools be able to sustain the next 5 years to come? Those are big questions that I feel are like not yet answered. And that would sort of define the landscape for LLMOps tooling. I wouldn't say it's a very well-defined term or, you know, a very well-defined landscape. It's not. It's still coming up. We'll probably have more clarity in it through the next 2 or 3 years, because the way at least I'm seeing things is right now everybody's rushing it to let's invest in these companies, let's invest in these companies. But eventually, at one point, things do dry out. If investors start asking also about profitability, and it doesn't really remain as such, like, okay, you've built a new tool, it went viral on GitHub, that's more than enough to be able to raise funding.
If you're enjoying this episode, come and carry on the conversation or just hang out in the Discord community by visiting deeplearningdaily.community. We also have a community newsletter on Substack that I'd love for you to check out. You can check that out by going to deeplearningdaily.substack.com. Now, back to the show. Let's go to Chris Brousseau. Chris Brousseau is in the building. Go for it, Chris.
Or Breed, Abby. Dude, it's great to see you guys. Abby, I have a really difficult question for you, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this, but I've struggled to find resources to point people to learn about the fundamentals of LLMOps outside of tooling. It seems like everybody is just, they're gunning for learning tools, they're recommending
tools
to make it easier. Where would you recommend people go to learn the actual fundamentals of how this works?
So I would say I may have to refer to my own stuff, which is I'm working on a report for O'Reilly that goes more so into the technology instead of the tools itself, which is more so about, you know, these are the problems and technical challenges with large language models. And these are the things that we need to think of. We're working within so-and-so technical constraints, but it won't be out, unfortunately, until October, November. So I am extremely sorry, but I'm not really seeing a lot of stuff that is already out on LLMOps specifically. There are a couple of blog posts that I've seen, but most of the blog posts, I would say, are very dispersed in the sense like there are some people who will focus very much on fine-tuning and evaluation part of the pipeline itself. And while there's nothing wrong with that, there are some people who will focus very much on like the security aspect. So for me, at least, like the way I look at the field is there are four different things that we need to start looking at. The first is basically the data engineering pipeline, which will continue to become more important as we go into the future, which is basically everything that we talked about during the initial part of this conversation. All of that stuff right now is still very much limited within research papers. I can leave a few research papers that are going into details of where is the best way to be able to sanitize the data? Where is the best way that we can think about their data implications? All of those things have been there. These are not new terms. Same goes for, you know, when it comes to security, which is there has been so much literature in open intelligence or past basically practices and all of that. So I don't feel like a lot of stuff is wrong. Stuff is already there, but I don't feel like there has been a lot of effort that has been put on combining a single resource, and it's going to take time for people to come up and start combining a lot of resources. I think till about mid of this year, the major focus or the big question for people was more like, hey, which metadata should we use? Should we use larger context window or smaller context window? So those were questions of big interest to people. And as such, the big thing is the part where LLM ops comes into play is when we start, you know, going from, do we really want to build this application to, we're sure that we want to build this application and we want to invest considerable resources into it for the next 5 years. But if we'll have big problems, which is you'll have to deal with problems such as hallucination, we'll have to deal with companies that are suing us and why Microsoft as a company or OpenAI as a company might be able to deal with the lawsuits that come from inaccurate prediction, that come from misclassification of the data. Not every company might be able to deal with that. So that is the awareness, which I don't feel like is there yet. There are some people who understand it, but a lot of people haven't been really putting a lot of effort into it. Some of the companies that I've seen putting some effort into it are companies like Arthur.ai that are creating a layer between the users and the models itself. So that basically at least you're not able to create drift with, or the right word is misalignment. Basically, the model doesn't get misaligned quickly because that's one of the big problems. Right now, I don't see a lot of people talking about misalignment right now. People are just talking about how do we deal with prop drift? That is still an open question. So the big questions when it comes to, are we able to build a product that is able to sustain for like 30 days or 2 months? Even those haven't been answered yet. So LLMOps more so comes into play when we build an entire team around it and have committed to more like, okay, we're going to spend the next 3-5 years to being the leaders in this space, to being a product which is going to use these kind of models. Yes, we'll have to put a lot of terminology around it. Yes, we'll have to put work around a lot of technical challenges that are out there. So I don't know how to answer that, but I would probably say I can leave some research papers, but that's more like what there is. They're not a lot of blog posts, unfortunately. And not a lot of reports.
Really relieved to hear you say that I'm not the only one struggling with pointing people to really solid resources in this area. That's just
true. Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely tough. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Abby. There's a bunch of great questions coming in from the audience. You know, we've got a question here from Asia, Matt Blaja, Swati, and Paul Fentress. We'll get to your questions. Questions coming in here about how to get started. That's not really the right place for this. We're not going to be talking about breaking into data science or anything like that. That's not going to be the place for this. But yeah, it sounds like, you know, in the development of an actual large language model, there are MLOps practices that you need to use. Data versioning, right? Experiment tracking, and, you know, all the rest of it, right? But for all the reasons you just mentioned, which are deployment challenges that are unique to language models that we don't see with, you know, traditional ML models or classical ML models, depending on how you want to frame it. Those challenges.
Yeah, nobody has the word for that thing yet.
Yeah. So yeah. So for all the reasons that you had mentioned, like this is why we need LLMOps, because the outputs, the way the outputs are generated for a large language model are really, really different from the way that they're, you know, generated from classical machine learning model, or even like a computer vision model. So that's kind of like my main takeaway from that. Let's move into some questions here. I think this question from Asia is good. It kind of on the heels of what we're just talking about, but the main challenges, what are the main challenges incorporating AI agents into software services and user interfaces? And I think we touched on that in the last few minutes here, but if you want to highlight maybe instead of like the main challenges, give me like the top two challenges that you see companies consistently running into.
So one of the big challenges that I've seen a lot of companies run into is evaluating the models. So the big challenge over there is, where is the evaluation strategy that we should be using? Should we be using metric-based strategies, or should we be using tool-based strategies or model-based, or should we have human in the loop? Main to use which one is still, and I would say, very much like an open question that most people in the field still trying to figure out. The second big one is, when do we fine-tune versus when do we do prompt engineering? That is still something that I feel like a lot of people are still sort of confused in. And so, I mean, I think I have a substantial answer to it. I'm not entirely sure, because again, it would depend on the real data set itself, which is basically both approaches work really well. You can do prompt engineering as well as you can do fine tuning. Prompt engineering works really well for embedded-based search. So if you already have the data set, if you already have the embeddings, it's going to work great. Ideally, you want to have those embeddings towards either the front or the end of the entire input or the entire data set that you're giving as well. And fine-tuning works really well when you're doing some sort of categorization or filtering. But as of now, I would say there's not really much a generalization that can be done, because there's so many applications that people are testing large language models on. So for example, like while that may work for, let's say, a legal document, now the big question is, does this work really well or equally well if they're thinking about solving a mathematical? That's where large language models have been failing miserably, or having anything where we need some sort of context of the world. So for example, if you try to get any sort of large language model to be able to create schedule for you or timetable for you, it doesn't really have the concept of 24 hours. It keeps messing those things up, even if you say these are by optimization. So right now, I would say it's not really well. It doesn't really work well for optimization, even if you give it all the context on earth that you want. So, and in those cases where inherently we are trying to change the behavior of the model, the fine tuning works really well. But again, it becomes more expensive and may not always be the right approach, depending on the complexity of the conditional itself. Because the sampling becomes really hard if you don't really know how to be able to factor the probability function ahead of time. So the evaluation becomes super hard. So I would say those are two big problems. The one is, when do we do fine-tuning versus prompt engineering? Open question, depending on the use case, depending on the kind of data set, depending on which industry are you looking at. And the second is basically evaluation. Those will continue to change.
That answers Paul's question, because Paul's question was, how do you choose when to fine-tune versus prompt engineering? And kind of the way I understand it is, like, if your main use case is, I need this language model to be aware of my data, then just use retrieval augmented generation. But if you're like, okay, I need this language model to respond, or rather change its default behavior to respond in a certain way, whether that response is having the output structured in a particular way, or just using language, particular language, legalese or something like that, then fine tuning is the way to go. Is that kind of like the high level like takeaway that would you agree with me, I guess, or do I have this right?
No, I would certainly say that is the right way of looking at it. And also, basically, if you want to reduce the size of the model as well, then probably you want to look at fine-tuning instead of prompt engineering itself, which is, let's say, if you want to use a smaller model, then prompt engineering might not be the better way to be able to test that. So, I mean, it comes down to, yes, if we're augmenting the behavior of the model, or if we want to augment the model itself, then we're doing fine-tuning. Otherwise, we're doing prompt engineering.
A question here from Matt Blaza. So we'll go to Matt's question, and then I like Ted's question here in the Q&A. Then we'll go to Ted's question. Then we'll touch on the questions here. I believe they're from Swati. So first question from Matt here. Matt, first praising Abby. Hey, Abby, love your talks. I'm wondering what sort of challenges that LLMs have for tokenization strategy if they're using multiple languages. Okay, that's interesting. So you've got a language model dealing with multiple languages, multiple human languages. How does tokenization strategy come into play here?
So I would say one of the ways I've seen tokenization happen in similar cases, basically doing batching of the data itself, which is creating different batches of the languages itself and then creating separate tokens for them instead of using a single one. But also it becomes one of those processes where I don't think there's a distinct answer to this, or, you know, determinate answer to this as well, which is it would very much depend on the use case itself and depend on where the languages that we are looking at and where is the inherent structure of those languages again when it comes to tokenization.
The question coming in here from Ted is, do you know any good resources for AI agents executing existing code from a code base with decent reliability? So far, LangChain or Open Interpreter suffer from running into errors because of missing necessary code parts when executing.
So I know there's a couple of people who are working on AI agents. Which ones are super reliable? I would say AutoGPT is one that you want to look at. Then you may also want to look at BabyAGI. But there's another one. There are two other ones that you would be interested in. One is by this company called Cognosis that is working really well in this space. And the second one is LogTin.io. So those are the ones that are really well versed when it comes to agents itself and their helping agents. And they have very good documentation as well. And their team is really nice, which is if you're working with them, if you get stuck in some part of the process that isn't really even technical, if you just need some advice, then and they're some of the nicest people to be able to.
Question here from Swati is, how are LLMs being utilized in legal research and document analysis to improve efficiency and accuracy in the legal sector?
So I would say this is very much, this answer would be very much hearsay because I have a couple of friends who've been working on LLMs, specifically a guy called Damien Reed. He's working very specifically on this problem in the legal space. What are the big challenges? The big challenges is basically fact correction or fact checking itself. How are they being used? They're being used for summarization. Very specifically, and to be able to create analogies. But a lot of analogies end up, you know, just hallucinating, which is basically just creating gibberish cases. So that's a report that I was seeing from a couple of friends who are working in that space. But again, I would say I'm not probably the best person to go that much in detail on like the legal space. I've not worked in it.
And a question coming in from Anonymous here about LLM deployment. And this is with respect to, you know, which framework do we use? There's, you know, number of frameworks. There's Ray. There's Hugging Face TGI, NVIDIA Triton, VLLM, DESI's Inferi engine. Maybe let's forget the question of which is the best framework. I guess, what considerations do we need to make when choosing a framework for deployment?
I think the first thing comes down to cost. So the second thing, again, it would come down to control. And the third thing would come down to iterative development, which is how regularly are they releasing new features in it. So when it comes to Ray, there's a really strong team behind it. They have also worked on a package called Avery that is basically for, you know, setting guardrails around the models itself. I wouldn't say it's the most complete tool, but at least they are pretty good in it, which means even if you've run into some problems or even if you want to figure out evaluations, you would be more likely to have to hop on a call and help you out if you're going with their service. But it's, I would probably say, I mean, if you're just starting off as an independent developer, it's a biased answer, but I would probably start with Hugging Face. most of the case, they just have alert models available, which you can easily switch using the API itself. And plus, they are very well supported with a lot of other APIs from different competing services, different data sources, other parts in the infrastructure itself. So I would probably say them, but again, this is one of those things, which is, I don't think there's one which is better than the other. Every company is doing interesting work. One company will release one thing, and then the other company a month later will release something else. So it comes down to which is affordable for you, which is the one that you're already using. If you're already using something, try to stick with it instead of jumping onto like a new one. If you must jump onto a new thing, then maybe start with Hugging Face and then adapt to something else, which is you can adapt to Triton, or you can sort of adapt to the one by Desi. But if you know people internally, if you know the people who are working on it, if you know what features are they prioritizing in the next release, then, and if they're consistent with your product and what you really need, then that's probably the best way to go by. And it comes down to like the big question in software development itself, which is, I was hearing the same question when you were picking up data catalogs as well, which is what's the best data catalog which is out there for our company to be able to use to organize all of the data and the metadata we have. I came down to, do you have in-house resources to be able to build your own? Which means, do you really need an external one? Or do you think you have people who can put a competing service? If not, then pick whichever is more popular, because most likely you're seeing adaptation. So for example, like I've seen the service by B7 Labs, I've seen the service by Roots and Bisons, I've played with them. I would say they're great. But again, they're very much relying on the community to tell them what are the features that they should be prioritizing, what is the next thing that they should be working. So, It's probably that, which is what's your budget and what's the right company to be able to support that budget and to scale it reasonably in that year.
You can check out Desi AI's open source work in a couple of places. First is Supergradients on GitHub. Supergradients is a PyTorch-based training library that simplifies computer vision workflows. It's got a model zoo with over 40 models, including YOLO-NAS and YOLO-NAS Pose. Supergradients offers advanced features such as post-training quantization, quantization-aware training, knowledge distillation, distributed data parallel, and a whole lot more right out of the box. These features can just be turned on with a simple flag. It makes working with deep learning models a breeze. Check out Supergradients on GitHub, and don't forget to star the library. You could also check out Desi's generative AI models on the Hugging Face organization by visiting huggingface.co/Desi. Now back to the show.
Very pragmatic approach. I like that a lot. Thank you, Abby. This is an interesting question coming in from Anonymous. Do libraries like LangChain have a future? Is it worth learning them in depth?
I would say this is a very similar question to should I learn Radiance or should I learn Swift? Do they have a future? Chances are, even if they do end up surviving past 4 or 5 years, the next library will be built on top of these ones. The way most of their machine learning libraries have been built in the past. So if you're looking at TensorFlow, if you're looking at PyTorch, they were built on the existing libraries like MXNet and all of that stuff. So is it worth learning? It can't hurt. I mean, plus you'll be able to build something for the next 5 years. So I would probably say, if you don't want to learn, then probably don't be on the engineering side. If you're on the engineering side, then just adapt, just learn. And the moment something new comes up, you would know what are the things that need to be prioritized. So maybe you can make contributions to the next library that's going to come.
Yeah, I like that perspective, because it's like at least for right now, and then at least for the next little while, the way we work with language models are not necessarily going to change. We might change the programming language, and syntax of that language, or how we interface with them, but like retrieval augmented generation is still going to need you to have an indexing system, a retrieval system, an augment system, right? You're still going to need to be able to load documents, chunk them, turn them into embeddings, store the embeddings. You're still going to need to do all these things. So just having that practice of understanding those high level patterns, I guess, are still going to be relevant.
Yeah, the fundamentals will still remain the same even if they add three more features and another library becomes more popular over a period of time, or they end up raising more money and have more engineers.
This question is coming in from Asia here. A little bit general question, but it's regarding expenses. How much would it cost to train two models and develop an MVP over a period of 4 to 6 months? I think I will take the answer of it depends, but let's hear from Abby.
No, I'll let you answer that one.
Yeah, the answer is it depends. So it depends on a lot. So that will be the answer there. So we got a couple minutes left here. And I guess, to kind of satisfy, there were a few questions that came in about, your own learning journey and how you broke into this field. Well, I don't want to touch on that question explicitly. I do want to touch on a post that you had made a while back. And it was essentially about the different roles now in this space, right? There's MLEs, there are AIEs, there's data scientists, so on and so forth. There's like this kind of distinction of roles and how one should navigate their trajectory through this role. So I think your perspective on that was really good. So I'd love to hear more about that.
That is still one thing which I've been trying to figure out, as in because there are different companies at such different stages within the space itself. So I would probably say this is one thing which I feel like it comes down to a simple thing, which is a lot of people ended up hiring data scientists and then quickly realized data scientists are really good at building the model, but they can't deploy the models. So I think if we start thinking more sort of from what's the deliverable here? And then think about the roles, then it would make more sense instead of thinking from it. Like, what is an ideal team to be able to support, an LLM function within an organization? So it comes down to, what is the real product? What is the step before that, before we need to release the product? The step that we need is we need to be able to connect to certain APIs. We need to be able to give it our data itself, and then for it to be integrated within the website. So that means basically we need one person. Now, if we have more budget, then what is the next problem that we'll likely solve? The next problem we'll likely solve is, can we somehow, depending on the problem, change the behavior of the model itself, inherently change the behavior of the model, which is when we start looking more so into fine-tuning itself. So when we start looking at fine-tuning, the most ideal person you want to have would probably, I would again start with an ML engineer over there, because you need the model to be packaged. You can't go without having a packaged service. So somebody who can turn the model into a service is the first person that you want to have on with you. Then if the person is not able to use an existing model, then you want to bring on a data scientist and to be able to create a very specific model. And then the next person you want to bring in is a data engineer. So very much like let's reverse engineer the deliverables and see what is the minimum that we can get available.
Thank you very much. That's a great conversation. Does not look like, there's a ton of questions left, but we're up on the hour and I want to be respectful of your time. Abby, thank you so much for taking time to join our conversation. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Harpreet.
And
thank you so much, everybody, for being here. If you have any more questions, you can message me on LinkedIn or tag me on Twitter or on Threads. I'm at GoEbiarian everywhere. Happy to answer everything.
Yes, be sure to follow Abby, stay connected with her, and then also, join the Deep Learning Daily community, deeplearningdaily.community. There's also the LLM Ops community that I'm part of with Abby. I don't have an easy shorthand for that, but it's on Discord. So I'll get you the link for it. We need to think about getting an actual URL for that. But deeplearningdaily.community, hope to see you guys there. Take care, everybody, and have a good rest of your day. Cheers.
Oh, Mert,
you got as long time. As you guys are following her feed, you'll find out all the links and all the
yeah. Yeah, definitely. Actually, I have some questions, but time is tight, so maybe I can ask in the Twitter.
Well, if you have another couple of minutes.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So actually, I think in the future, we are going to get to the point that we can take inference these big LLM applications inside of the low-level hardware, like maybe your iPhone, your old phone, I don't know. But how we are going to reach that point and what are the pain points of this problem?
So one of the quickest things we can do to get to that point is basically knowledge distillation itself, which is basically the model compression. So that's one of the ways. And the way we're doing that, which is it's already being done, which is some people are looking at quantized model to be able to decrease the size of the model itself. So basically a four-quant model would obviously be able to run on a smaller devices. And there are already people who are running it on Raspberry Pis and mobile devices. The big question would be, you know, what are the limitations? The big limitations are the accuracy does drop after a certain point. What is that certain point? And is that like an acceptable threshold for whatever problem that we're solving? It would depend as we see more applications. So as of now, the prominent companies that I was following or that I was seeing in the IoT space or in this edge ML space were companies like EdgeImpulse and OctoML, and there was Desi that was specifically working on these challenges. I've not really seen them while they have worked extensively on creating infrastructures to be able to run deep learning models and transformer models on various small devices. But I've not seen a lot of work from their companies, except for from Desi, to be able to run them on like a Raspberry Pi. So because again, it depends, they need to work with the hardware as well. So I don't think the support has come yet, at least not for EdgeImpulse. That's the one I keep checking constantly.
Yeah, thank you.
Keep an eye out for stuff out of Desi. We're doing big things in that very domain. But thank you guys so much for being here. Cheers. Wow, there's another question coming here from Claire Longo that I'll pose real quick.
Okay.
All this talk of LLMs and language models is exciting, but do you think there will be similar models coming for computer vision? This is coming in on LinkedIn. And my response to that was, I think we have some version of that with models like SAM and just the work that was coming out of the ImageBind paper and, you know, the potential that lies hidden in that paper. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are around that, Abby.
I think obviously it's the way, at least if we look at history to be able to predict the future or to do forecasting of any sort, then the progress in the field has happened in cycles, which is we've been from WordNet to then working extensively in computer vision for a couple of years. And then us discovering or working with GANs, and then eventually it was transformers all over again. And everybody was excited about transformers. Now it's large language models. So we've had two iterations of language models. I would probably say the next one is definitely on computer vision. One of the big reasons is that, you know, the big adaptation of these models is in multimedia industries. And that's where things are innovating really quickly, which is, so companies like Runway ML, I'm not entirely sure if they've run out of funding already or were they on the verge of running out of funding. Did they do something great? But there are plenty of companies that are working in that space, which is video synthesis. And if we are able to prompt or edit videos, I know, for example, Adobe is doing really, really good work when it comes to computer vision, as well as in audio synthesis right now. Also, NVIDIA is doing really, really good work. They went to release a lot of stuff, but expect that stuff to come by next year. As of now, they are doing beta testing. So I'm involved in some of the beta testing with Adobe for their audio, for a lot of their work in audio space. So yeah, video is coming as well.
Thank you very much, Abby. And this is the official goodbye. Thank you guys for that was the encore. That was the false goodbye. And then the encore. So this is the real one. Thank you everybody for joining us today. Appreciate you being here. Cheers, everybody. Take care. And again, thank you, Abby. Bye, everybody.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.